So if anybody thinks they're somewhere that they're not, you know, if you're in the wrong place, you can leave now. Okay. I don't know Karen, but I'm introducing her. My name's Sarah Beth. I work with HPost, which is why I'm introducing her. Karen is from Surrey, and she's speaking to us, which I think is quite neat, on worldview issues and how to teach worldview topics, just exactly what we've been hearing about the whole of today, to our children. It seems like you're primarily focusing on high school age.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Karen's been homeschooling for quite a while, and she says that this is a journey she started about 3 years ago to explore this whole thing of worldview and introducing worldviews. Are you confused?
No,
are you in the wrong spot?
No,
you're not. Okay, good.
I'm just engrossed.
Oh, you're engrossed. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, I think you're still homeschooling your last child, is
yes.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
great.
Karen.
Thanks, Sarah Beth. Well, it is so good to be here again. This is always a highlight for me every year. As I was preparing this speech, I thought, wow, Karen, another heavy topic. Can't I just find something light and funny? You know, every year it seems like it's a heavy thing, but hopefully we'll keep it as light as we can with the world views. My oldest son is 20, the second son is 18, and then my daughter is 14. So I have about 3 years left in homeschooling, and I'm very sad about that. But I've gone back to school myself in hopes of getting a degree in as a teacher, and then maybe the Lord will open up opportunities for me to teach outside the home. So I'm really glad that you've come here. And as Sarah Beth said, I start to find out about worldviews about 3 years ago. There was a seminar here by Summit Ministries that talked all about it, and I took it and I realized, wow, this is what I'm missing in equipping my children for when they graduate from high school. So the last 3 years I've taken courses, I've taught small groups, all sorts of things, and I'm just really grateful to be able to share what I've been able to learn the last 3 years with you. My motivation primarily for presenting on this topic this year is that my oldest son is in the second year of university, and this year I've taken a look at some of his English novels, skimmed them. I've talked with him about some of his essays, and he's at a secular university, and I just realized how toxic it is out there. And I thought, we really have to make sure that our children are prepared to recognize the error of other worldviews, to even recognize somebody else's bias, so that they won't get confused and so that it won't influence them. And this past year I've also spent some time really grieving as I saw Christian youth graduating from high school and completely abandoning their faith. And I thought, what is missing? We are pouring ourselves into our children sacrificially, and so many, the statistics are dreadful, they leave their faith after high school. And I think the information about counterfeit worldviews is one piece of it. It is not the final answer. I think there's other pieces that we're missing, and I'm not quite sure yet what they are, but this worldview bit is one important part. And so I'm really glad to be able to share with you about it today. So I'm really hoping, my prayer for all of you has been that the Holy Spirit will highlight what you need, what your children need, so that they're better able to stand up for what they believe, to really see where other worldviews will take them, because we all have different families, right? We all have different children. And so I really am reliant on the Holy Spirit to just make it clear to you, how do I take this, how do I incorporate it, you know, to help my own children. So actually, before I start, I want to start with prayer. Holy Father, we come before you through the Lord Jesus, and I just thank you for your daily presence in all of our lives. I lift up these precious parents to you, and I just ask that your Holy Spirit would highlight what they need to better equip their children. You know where all of us are. You know the things we will encounter. And I just thank you for your care and your help in our lives. I give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so this is all about worldviews. You can, I don't know, you're probably as busy as I am, but I didn't very carefully read about the keynote speaker before I got here. So I sit down at the opening session and I open it and I go, let's see who this guy is. I'm like, oh, professor of worldview. This is great. I think I'll walk out the back door now. And so I'm sitting through his session thinking, please let there not be too much overlap. Please let there not be too much overlap. But I think we're okay. He had his different slant. So anyway, worldview, I want to make sure that we all know what we're talking about, because otherwise this is going to be sort of abstract. And some of you are going to be very familiar with worldview, some of you it's a brand new concept. So anybody want to throw out a definition for a worldview? How would you describe it? How do you understand it? Any?
It's a paradigm, it's a grid work through which you see things.
Perfect, yeah, exactly. A worldview is just a way of understanding the world and your place in it. It's a system of beliefs. They're a collection of convictions. You can describe it that way too. And it shapes your values, it shapes your thoughts, and it shapes your actions. And at the core of every worldview, five essential questions are answered. And each worldview will have its own answer. And they are this. How did life begin? Which is the question of origins. What am I? The question of identity. What is my purpose, or why am I here, which is the question of meaning. Is there a right or wrong, and who gets to decide? And the last one, is there life after death, which is the question of destiny. So those really essential core questions are the ones that every worldview will ask. There are also other questions in many other disciplines, but those are the really key ones. At the university, all studies are divided into 10 disciplines. Theology, philosophy, biology, psychology, sociology, ethics, law, politics, economics, and history. So all what your children would study if they go to post-secondary falls into one of those disciplines. Every worldview has a belief statement under each one of those disciplines. But of course, we can't cover all of it. So as I introduce the other worldviews, I'm just going to focus on the five core questions. So everybody has a worldview, even if they don't realize it, even if they can't articulate it. It is amazing how many times, you know, if you ask somebody, so what is your purpose in life? You get a completely blank look. They've never thought about it. They don't know how to verbalize it. And even if the worldview is inconsistent, everybody has one. Because if you peel back what people do, why they do it, and how they spend their money, at the root, it's a belief statement. So we all have them, even though we may not realize it. And we absorb it or we choose it by our surroundings and our media. Now, before I really get into the worldviews, I just want to emphasize how important it is that you and your children have a very solid biblical worldview. Please do not introduce counterfeit worldviews until you know God's position on those 10 different areas, because it's going to be confusing and it's going to feel like a potpourri. They have to be really grounded first. And sometimes, you know, depending on whether or not you're sitting under expository preaching, depends on the Sunday school, depends on a lot of different things, there are holes. And they'll have a lot of information about their faith and that sort of thing, but the understanding of that God has spoken about all areas of life sort of is missing. I know I certainly was hazy several years ago. So as a quick survey, sort of as a quick assessment tool, I'm going to read 10 belief statements. And in your head, I'm not going to embarrass anybody, this is just a personal assessment for yourself. I want you to say true or false, okay, to yourself, with these 10 belief statements that I'm going to read from different worldviews in the 10 different areas. And there are more handouts here if, maybe we should put them at the back, so that'd be great. Okay. So, answer in your head, true or false. Under theology, the devout and obedient Muslim will be in heaven because of his or her devotion and obedience to God. In the area of philosophy, the existence of what one encounters in the world is dependent on human thought.
Say that again, sorry.
Sure. The existence of what one encounters in the world is dependent on human thought. biology, origins. Natural selection explains complexity in organisms. Ethics. What is right and wrong does shift with the time in history and the culture. Sociology. A healthy society is built on small, committed groups of people who love each other. Under the area of law, obeying laws is a matter of individual conscience. Politics. It is the government's responsibility to provide good health care. Economics. Free enterprise only benefits mega corporations. And last but not least, history. It is almost impossible to figure out what really happened in the past. Okay, the answer to that quick little survey, they're all false. And so that's not to make anybody feel badly, and maybe you all answered false to them, but if you're not sure on some of them, take a look at it, because God has clearly spoken into these 10 areas. And I don't have the time to explain why they're false, you know, but I have a sign-up sheet over there. If you want to give me your email, I'll send you why, the reason, so it's not going to keep you up at night, you know. I think she was wrong. Can she really support that? So if you want, just give me your email, and I'll send that information to you. So it's just so important that they have a biblical worldview. And why is it important? Pretty obvious, because God has expressed his position in all of these areas. Our faith is not just dependent on does God exist. He has a position in every one of these 10 major areas in life. And as representatives and ambassadors, it's key that we know his position, and that we understand it, and that we live it. Otherwise, we're really misrepresenting him. And isn't the whole point of homeschooling that we want to pass on our faith to our kids and have them hold strong to it and make a difference in the world? God's position is the best one, because he created everything and he knows how it's supposed to function and how it will function properly. His position always brings blessing. It is actually the only worldview that is a consistent and truthful explanation of reality. The biblical worldview is based on truth, and as we stand in alignment with it, then we're really the salt and light of the world. The biblical worldview, as you probably are very well aware, is no longer prevalent in our culture, so we're steeped in countercultures all the time. And so if we want to protect ourselves from absorbing erroneous perspectives, we have to clearly know God's position. Really importantly, all ideas have consequences. It's not like a bag of Smarties and you go, well, some people pick red and some people pick blue and at the end it's just a Smartie, right? No, this is depending on whether you pick, whichever worldview you pick, it makes a huge difference. It will take you down much different paths. So a consistent biblical worldview is one way of protecting and equipping our children to hold to the truth and really make a difference in their culture. And I have used curriculum over the last 3 years to inform myself and to also teach it to my children. And a lot of it comes from Summit Ministries. I have some resources up here after the presentation. You're welcome to take a look at them just so you can see if that's something that would actually help you. But Summit Ministries has phenomenal curriculum for all sorts of ages to teach you about what God says in all those areas in life at the different levels. And right now I'm going through this one, which is for grade 7. It's Light Bearers, but I'm using it with my grade 9 daughter, and will probably take 2 years to finish it. You know, it's the sort of thing where you use it as it fits, but this is phenomenal. It comes with DVDs, which has movie clips that really gets them thinking, and I couldn't put this together myself if I had the time. It's a really excellent thing. So that gets them thinking, because biblical worldview can be done at any age, as long as it's at their level. But when it comes to the counterfeits, as long, if they're really mature, 15, but usually 16, 17, 18, they need to be at the end of their, you know, high school years for them to really be able to process it. So at the back of your handout, there's a list of websites, and all of those have incredible resources on them that will really help you if you want some support with the biblical worldview. Okay, so you came to hear about other worldviews, not the biblical one. So over the next 45 minutes or so, I want to just introduce them. And I'll be honest with you, we're not touching the tip of the iceberg here, we're licking it. There's a lot, but that's all right. It's just a beginning. I also want to show you how to discern error in other belief statements and to point you into the direction of some great resources that I found. There's probably a lot more resources than this. It's just what I'm familiar with and what I have used. So I am really hoping that this does not leave you overwhelmed, you know, oppressed. I hope you walk out feeling, yeah, this might be something that I need to add to what I talk to my kids about. And I can do this, right? So I really hope that you leave equipped and not going, oh, wow, it's all over. You know, I haven't done it right. You know, because I really started this in the last 3 years with my children, and they're now 20, 18, and 14. So I could have felt that I was missed the boat, but better late than never, right? We also have to remember that believers have been contending with other worldviews right from the beginning of the church. The New Testament church, they dealt with paganism. They dealt with legalism. They dealt with the teachings of the Nicolaitans. Like, counterfeit worldviews have been around since the beginning. And so we just have a different variety right now. So it's nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. When it comes to worldviews, actually, there's a lot more than the five I'm going to talk about, because any word ending with an ism is a worldview. It's just that you take the word before the ism, and that's how you interpret life. That's how you funnel your understanding and make sense of life. So, for example, feminism is a worldview, and all of life is understood through the female perspective, right? So there's a lot of other worldviews, but these are the ones that I'm going to talk about are the five main ones. Because of the restraint of time, too, as I introduce these worldviews, I'm just going to talk about how they answer the five core questions. Because if I gave you their belief statements for all 10 disciplines, we would all be numb by the time we left here. So we're just going to restrict it a bit. This is just to give you an idea of what's out there. Okay, well, so we'll start with the most familiar one, as Michael was already talking about, secular humanism. So, humanism, mankind, is the defining lens through which all of life is interpreted. Most familiar with us, we've all grown up in this for the most part, most atheists and agnostics fall under this category. Humanism was born out of the corruption of the church in the Middle Ages. For those of you who have taught ancient Rome and history, you know that the Roman world had control of the civilization. And then as they couldn't defend their borders, the barbarians started to crumble the Roman Empire. And after a while, during the Middle Ages, it was all chaotic. There was no law. There was no safety. There was wars. It was just a mess. The only thing that was consistent and steady was the church. And so people in desperation for security and some help clung to the church. And the church grew. And so all of life started to revolve around the church. And as the church grew, it became more influential. And as it became more influential, it became more powerful. And as it became more powerful, it became more corrupt. Until the end of the Middle Ages, it didn't offer help to anybody or comfort. And so if the church wasn't offering answers, society turned to themselves. The church doesn't have the answers, we'll turn to ourselves. And so that's how humanism was born. Martin Luther, with his Reformation, did rebirth the original mandate of the church and did make a huge difference, but it was almost too late for the influence of, you know, the whole society. Humanism had taken off. And so you'll see that in the Renaissance, that humanism is just flowering. And if you ever want to sort of get a feel for where a culture is at, look at their art. During the Middle Ages, you look at the artwork, religious scenes, almost all of them. You look at the Renaissance, people. Mankind is now at the pinnacle. And so, a huge shift there. And so, of course, since that time, humanism has just grown and grown and grown until, as we've heard this morning with our keynote speaker, it's everywhere. It's the prevailing worldview. So, Christianity has really diminished, of course, in its influence, and secular humanism is very, very dominant. So there are answers to the key questions. How did life begin? Well, as you know, evolution, spontaneous generation is their answer. Only matter exists, so after death there is nothing. So humanism is very naturalistic. So basically, as you know, the material world is all that exists. So no God, no angels, no demons, no hell, nothing supernatural. I'm going to read a quote by a leading humanist, George Simpson, which really sums it up. Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. He was not planned. He is a state of matter, a form of life, a sort of animal, and a species of the order primates, akin nearly or remotely to all of life and indeed to all that is material. So that sums up their view of how life started, and also how they just view human beings. And as was also mentioned this morning, is John Dewey. He was the guru to public schools and a leading humanist, and so it comes as no surprise that our public school system is completely secular humanistic, and evolution is taught as a fact, not as a theory. To the question, what am I? Why am I here? The humanist says, okay, you're an evolved organism, and you just respond to external and internal stimuli. But supposedly, you're innately good. I haven't quite figured that one out. You're shaped by genetics and environment, and you are responsible for your continued progress and improvement of the species. That's why you're here, okay? So, what's right or wrong? Moral relativism. Right and wrong is dependent on the person and on the circumstances. And where are they headed? Nowhere. There's no existence after death. Okay, so that sort of sums up secular humanism, and that's the most prevalent in our society. Then there's something that's also really grown, and that's called transcendentalism, or which is a mouthful, or cosmic humanism. And this stems from the Far East, and it includes such religions as Buddhism, Shintoism, Hinduism, Taoism, and also New Age. New Age is actually a westernized mix of that worldview that's become really popular because many movie stars have picked it up and promoted it, and it shows up strongly in such popular movies like Star Wars, you know, that sort of thing. So in this worldview, their answer to origins, they don't actually focus very much on how the physical world came to be, because they don't actually really care about the physical world that much. It's probably a manifestation of infinite energy. Okay, so this is the most far out worldview, so to speak. They read, most of them, yes? Yeah, that's where it comes from. Most of these religions reject both theism, which is a belief in God, and atheism, interesting enough, in that there is no God. They have something else called pantheism, which is the belief that God is everything and everything is God. Okay? So God is an impersonal force, and we and everything that exists, trees, rocks, us, stars, whatever, they're all part of this God consciousness, this energy field. Okay? A quote from Understanding the Times, cosmic humanist biology is based on a belief in positive evolutionary change over time. This approach does not focus on physical change as much as it emphasizes humanity moving upward towards an age of higher consciousness. Cosmic humanists believe that everything is ultimately energy that will allow people to achieve unity with each other in a kind of collective consciousness. I find it a little mind-bending, but I'm just quoting. So their answer to what am I is, you're an individual part of the ultimate and universal consciousness, or energy, or force. You're just a piece of it. And you're responsible to becoming increasingly aware of your spiritual self, your godness, and getting greater unity with everything else. another quote from Understanding the Times on this concept. Each of us has access to a superconscious, creative, integrative, self-organizing, intuitive mind whose capabilities are apparently unlimited. This is the part of our consciousness that constitutes our godlikeness. So this is very different from humanism, even though they have the word humanism in their worldview too. For ethics, you need to get in touch with the God consciousness to know what's right or wrong. So really, it's moral relativism. Whatever is right for you and your circumstances. Anything is justifiable except absolutes. That is not justifiable. And they're really into karma. So, you know, in the next life reincarnation, if you were good, you go up. If you were bad, you go down. Life form? Yeah. So that's where it fits into the worldview. Where am I headed? Collective consciousness means that the ultimate end of the individual is to expand into the universal oneness, which really means that the individual disappears as a separate person. I don't know what they find appealing about this. I really don't. I think it's the godlikeness thing, but if they really think about what else it's saying, like I don't know what the attraction is.
It has a lot to do with if you see an ant, that you can be one with the ant and you shouldn't kill it, and the ant is part of you and even the tree, and if something bothers you, that if you try to use your energy to influence it, then it'll stop bothering you and it's really...
Okay, you're trying to really create harmony with all of life. Yes, maybe that's, they're seeking peace, and maybe that's their route to it. So now each of the different religions, like the Shintoism, Hinduism, they have different pathways to realizing your own godlikeness, but at the end, the ultimate destiny is to being absorbed into this universal consciousness. So you lose the personal self. So that's cosmic humanism. Then we're on to Marxism or Leninism. Now, you may be sitting there going, I think that's dead, right? I think the world is done with communism. Because I grew up, you know, when communism was the big threat. Now, my children are growing up with Islam as the big threat. But no, this worldview has not disappeared. They just have the same philosophy under new terminology, a new banner, and often shaped as socialism. So the agenda is with us, but the party name is not. So they've just sort of reinvented themselves, given themselves a new face. So how did life begin for them? Punctuated evolution. And so the evolutionists got really tired of the criticism, where are your missing links, you know? Like, where are the cross species? And so they came up with a new version of evolution called punctuated evolution, which says there was no change for a really long time, or it was a really slow change. And then for whatever reason, there's very, very rapid change for a brief time. And then nothing, or very little, and then lots. And so the reason we don't have any missing link species in the fossil form is because, you know, the period was so short. I kid you not, this is what they have come up with. So Marxism believes in punctuated evolution. Of course, they're very atheistic, absolutely no supernatural, because they're also materialistic. Only the material world exists. So their question to what am I and why am I here? Man is a product of genetics and environment. Behavior is more or less understood in a Pavlovian sort of concept. We're all conditioned, okay? So they want the government to control the people so that they can shape and construct a perfect society. It's a way of reaching utopia on Earth. Unfortunately, the individual is sacrificed for the collective good. And it's, like I said, man's attempt for peace on Earth. And it will fail, because any country that's tried this system has ended up in economic disaster and the most horrendous human rights abuses. Their answer for what is right or wrong? Whatever advances the working class and communism is good. Everything else is bad. So it's a collective morality. And they see Christianity as the greatest hindrance to their goals. They're vehement about this. Where am I headed? Same as secular humanism, oblivion. There's nothing after death. And the most obvious signs in our culture that they are having a big influence is in political correctness and the intolerance spirit of our times. And they have made significant inroads in the universities. It's huge. It's interesting, though, they're really only very popular in the Western world. In the universities under communism, it's not quite so popular. Anyway, Islam. This worldview is no longer contained to the Middle East, but through immigration has made huge inroads to Western countries such as Britain and France. Britain and France are in huge trouble. And Britain has even instituted Sharia law. I don't know how they can do this. So their Muslims can be tried under Sharia law, even though they're British citizens. And it's just a dreadful mess. So there's been real infiltration there. This last month I was going through the newspaper and saw this article, Islamist leader imposes Sharia law. So Sharia law is the law that comes out of the Quran. And it is very, very harsh. And you think that it doesn't really exist anymore, but in, let's see, Mali, where this is, yep, Mali, they have an Islamic state, and somebody just had their hand cut off for stealing in a public place. If you're caught in adultery, you're stoned. Like, it is harsh, harsh, harsh. And here we have Western countries allowing the Sharia law in.
Are you saying this is actually happening in
This happened in Mali, so not in England yet, but Britain does have Sharia law as part, which is just dreadful. And in fact, 2 or 3 years ago, they tried to get Sharia law into Canada. But thankfully, somebody was awake, and some Muslim women stood up and testified and said, absolutely not, we don't want this in. And so, you know, they didn't make the inroads. They're very subtle. They have lots of time on their hands, and they are pushing this stuff. And not just them, but others. So Islam is a major force in our world, as you all know. So what's their answer to how life began? They believe that Allah created the world. So they're theistic, like Judaism and Christianity. They believe in a creator, a supreme being, but no Trinity. So they share, their Allah shares many similar attributes to our God. You know, he's all-powerful, he's everywhere, he's a God of judgment, that sort of thing. But he's very different in significant ways. So Allah is a God of wrath, and you have to try to please him by being submissive to his commands. And there's no personal relationship possible, because he's so distant. And all you can do is know his commands and obey him and hope to please him. So it's a real works-based religion, and there's no certainty of heaven. They just have to keep working at it. So Islam is a real mix of paganism and Judaism, actually, and Christianity. And I found this fascinating to learn this in the last few years, that Muhammad lived in a center that was on the trade routes. And so he was very, as the caravans came through, he was exposed to Judaism and Christianity. And so what he did is he took the paganism, which had, you know, many gods, and in paganism, every village has its own main god. And Muhammad's, the god for Muhammad's tribe was Allah, the moon god. And so when he got these revelations, this idea to start a new religion and unify the Arab world under this one religion, he elevated his village god, Allah, to the top, said there aren't any others, and mixed in Judaism ideas, Christianity. So you'll find Moses in the Quran, you know, you'll find Abraham in there. It's amazing. You'll even find Jesus mentioned in the Quran, and then also his extra revelation. And he's mixed this all together. So that's Islam. Their answer to, what am I and why am I here? You're created by Allah. You're dual in nature, which means you have a body and you have a soul. Okay? A lot of the other worldviews, such as humanism, Marxism, postmodernism, you don't have a soul. So they share that with us, that we're dual in nature. But you do not have a fallen nature. They believe that you're born good and your environment corrupts you. And why are they here? They are created to submit to Allah. That's the bottom line. Muslim means submission, one who submits. And where are they headed? They are headed for judgment. They know that they will stand before Allah one day, and He will weigh their good and their bad deeds. And depending how the way the scale goes, that will say they get to go to heaven or to hell. So many similarities with us. Okay, the postmodernism, which is the newest worldview, it grew out of, as mentioned this morning also, out of the disillusioned West. As the hopes for humanism to answer the problems to life, communism were dashed, they turned to postmodernism. And I would like to quote Lawrence Calhoun, who's a postmodernist. During its early years, Marxism promised a this-world salvation for the enlightened irreligious. However, with the passage of time and countless body bags, the idea of a Marxist utopia was eventually revealed for what it was, a mirage. As a result, postmodernism was birthed as a wayward stepchild of Marxism, and in a sense, a generation's realization that it is orphaned. Because what they were really hanging their hats on, that it would make a difference, that it would take care of poverty, take care of injustice, did not happen. It's just crumbled. Postmodernists, when it says how did life begin, they really stay away from endorsing any theory, but if they will admit to one, it's the punctuated evolution. They reject all overarching meta-narratives, so no universal truths, no absolute truths. So they're atheistic, they're also anti-science, that sort of thing. The question to what am I and why am I here, there are no clear-cut answers. To who you are, there's no separate, single, unified self. So they maintain that you have many selves, very fragmented. They believe that you're a social construction, and that you attribute meaning whichever way you want to your life. Right and wrong, cultural relativism, whatever is the norm in your society. And where are you headed? Well, nobody can know for sure, but probably nowhere. And this very sad worldview with no foundation is made significant inroads in the universities, especially in English, the literature. It is depressing, I tell you. So that's just a quick overview of the five major worldviews, other than theism, which of course Judaism and Christianity falls under. Okay, so why is it so important that your teenagers, your older teens, sort of have an idea of these worldviews out here? And I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis, and this is from the 1950s, and he's talking to other educators, and he's really trying to give a rallying cry. And C.S. Lewis said way back then already, "To be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have, under God, no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered." So C.S. Lewis was really crying out to educators to say, don't abandon the intellectual field where there's debate. You have to be able to speak to the criticisms or to the belief statements of others. Otherwise, there's no representation of the truth. And in the early 1990s, Dr. James Dobson and Gary Bauer sought to identify what was happening with our youth. That's already, 20 years ago. And they said that nothing short of a great civil war of values was going on for the hearts and minds of our kids. And so they have done a lot of things to try to counter that. The Truth Project has come out of Focus on the Family, which I've heard is really excellent. From Understanding the Times, it says, a clear understanding of these six worldviews will not only help protect us from deception by grounding us more firmly in the Christian faith, but will also give us tools to more effectively witness for Christ in these conflicting times. Christianity is not about who is nicest. I somehow absorbed that when I was growing up. I thought it was about being nice. And as I've gotten older, I realized it has nothing to do with being nice. It has to do about living the truth and challenging error. And because I remember maybe 10 years ago, and you'd meet a non-Christian, whatever, and it was sort of like, I felt this competition, like who could be nicest, you know, and the nicest person was right and had the truth. Forget it, right? That's not the point. We're supposed to be salt and light in our culture instead of conforming to it. And to challenge the culture effectively, we have to know where they're coming from, and we have to offer better arguments, better support for what we believe. Part of our responsibility as Christians is to cast down or overthrow arguments that exalt itself against the knowledge of God. And that's from 2 Corinthians 10:5, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So we've got a spiritual, biblical mandate there. And when you understand the influences that your children are going to be under, and they can recognize the errors of it, then they can stand up for truth. And if you think of any of the Christian greats, Bonhoeffer, Luther, Carmichael, tons of them, they recognized the error in their culture around them, and they stood up and spoke the truth. We have to know what others believe so that we can make a difference. Otherwise, we'll be talking with somebody and we'll have the same terminology. You can talk to a New Ager and we'll think, wow, we have a lot in common. We're using the same things like peace and God and that sort of thing, and they have completely redefined it. You're not even talking about the same thing. And then, of course, you miss each other and you can't help them. So all the worldviews are very pervasive in our culture, in the universities, except for Islam. Islam is still somewhat segregated to certain pockets. So unless we can recognize the errors, we're going to absorb it. It's just so, you know, the media, the movies, the magazines, the newspaper, it's all in there. And if you don't look at it critically, you just sort of absorb it. It just sounds good, you know, that sort of thing. I think that one of the reasons, perhaps, why so many Christian young people leave their faith is because you grow up with the truth. So on one hand you have the truth, and on the other hand you have reality. Just because we have the truth doesn't mean we don't struggle in our marriages, doesn't mean we don't struggle with sibling rivalry, doesn't mean we don't struggle with finances. We still have reality, we have difficulties. And so they live with these two things, and they're going, well, it certainly didn't fix everything, right? And they get out there, and they hear other things, and they think, maybe there are better answers elsewhere. The other fields look greener. And so if they can't see where the other ideas will take them, the consequences of it, and that it's completely bankrupt, they'll buy into it, right? Our children need to understand that our faith doesn't make everything perfect, right? It gives us a different destiny, a different path to walk, but it doesn't make everything perfect in this world. So I think that's one of the reasons why we're losing them. So how do you refute these worldviews? The best way to demolish an argument is to point out its inconsistencies and to offer a better argument. All the non-biblical worldviews have weaknesses because they're out of sync with reality. They have made things up to avoid having to accept God. So once you recognize the weakness, then it can be contrasted with the truth that we have in the biblical worldview. So how do you recognize the error? Well, you need to find the belief statement, and then you can hold it up to the biblical worldview and see, does it conflict, right? If it conflicts, well, you know which one to choose. But there's another way to do it too. Because most of these belief statements sound really good, like they really sound benign until you start to take them apart. And there's a test, a three criteria test for truth. So you can do this with any worldview in any subject. The first one is logical consistency. A true worldview statement will not contradict itself. Okay? So you have to have logical consistency. The second one is factuality. A true worldview will fit the facts. And viability. You have to be able to live consistently with it. Otherwise, it's not worth it. So what I want to do is look under secular humanism and just pull this apart for you, just to give you an idea of how to do this. And so under secular humanism, in the area of the knowledge, you know, how can we know what's true and what's real? And the humanists, as you know, are naturalists, so only matter exists. So all phenomena can be explained in terms of natural causes. That's as much as they have to go with. And so they believe that everything you can know can be discovered through the scientific method. And so this is the foundation for knowledge. So your child goes to university and they hear about the scientific method and how it's objective and the experiments are repeatable and this is how you can really know something. And it sounds so good. Like, where are the problems? Like, why is naturalism defunct? And you know, they may not remember that with this worldview, they have to give up, you know, God and their soul and individual value and all that. It just sounds like a really good way to know objective truth. So where's the error in naturalism? So let's hold it up to the three criteria. Logical consistency. It's inconsistent for a naturalist to argue that naturalism is objective. And that's why you should choose it. And why? Because a naturalist says that only matter exists. And if that is true, then all thoughts are only biological stimuli. They're only the firing of neurons to response to internal and external stimuli. So the naturalist loses the concept of reason, because reason is a byproduct of the mind and not the brain. And so the concept of the intellect really is sacrificed, because all the naturalist has is randomly arrived at by responding to their environment. They can't think outside of themselves because they only have the material world. And so they're really dependent on the proper functioning of their brain and the stimulus. And so the conflict is naturalism in the mind. The mind is separate from the brain. And they have tried very hard with different theories to try to get it to mesh, but it's pretty convoluted and gets pretty confusing. But that's one of the problems with naturalism. You lose the concept of a mind, which allows abstract, rational reasoning. Under factuality for naturalism. So they say that the universe is eternal, that it's been going on forever and it will go on forever. Unfortunately for them, astronomers have found evidence that the universe actually had a beginning. So scientists have discovered this. Also, second law of thermodynamics says that energy dissipates over time. And so there's no way that the universe can go on forever. It has a certain amount of energy and it is running down. It is running out. So the conflict in naturalism for factuality is that the facts that science has discovered doesn't match up with their belief. And under viability, most people attach value to their own life. That they're important, that they make a difference, that they're unique. But that sort of sense of value is completely inconsistent with naturalism, because under naturalism there's no foundation for considering anybody unique. You're just an evolved species. So the conflict is, who can live as evolved slime with no purpose, no value, and no destiny, you know, and say that, yeah, I still have value? You can't. You've got no basis for it in naturalism. So if your children understand that about naturalism and they go to the university, and then they won't be awed or swayed by the attitude and teaching that science is king, that science got all the answers, that anything that's worth knowing, you can find out by science. They'll know the limitations of naturalism, and it won't influence or confuse them. So it really will help them. So these steps, you know, can be applied to all of the worldviews and all of the 10 disciplines. The criteria of logical consistency, then factuality and viability, can apply them to all. I just want to do one more, and that's with postmodernism. Okay, so postmodernism says, as it pertains to truth, that knowledge is relative. Might be right for me, but might be wrong for you. It's subjective. It'll change from culture to culture and history. And it's non-universal. They really believe this. Okay, so let's look at this logically. Within their own framework, they deny any absolute statements. And then they go ahead and make one themselves. They say, the truth is that there is no truth. Honest. They do. So the problem is that's completely self-refuting. If there is no truth, then they don't have anything to say either. Factually, it doesn't correlate to reality at all. there are universal truths that you can objectively know. All over the world, since the beginning of time, if you put your hand in the fire, you destroy tissue. Doesn't matter whether you think it should or shouldn't, or, you know, it's objective, right? So conflict is that their theory doesn't support reality, or reality doesn't support their theory. And viability. Can you actually live with this worldview? Well, I'm going to read a quote here from Josh McDowell's New Evidence That Demands a Verdict. A person could not function or live very long if he consistently acted as though truth were prospectival rather than objective. He would bounce checks because his bank account has money to him. He would fall through thin ice that is thick to him, or get hit by a bus that is not moving to him. To a person who wants to function effectively and live in the world, truth's objective correspondence to reality must matter in some sense. So you can only live in a world where you accept the fact that some things are objective and true for everybody, and you need to respond to it regardless of your perspective. So it's not livable. Now, when you analyze the worldviews this closely, they all look absurd. They look like a house of cards, that they are, and you're like, oh, why worry? Like, who would really buy into that anyway, right? But the challenge, as I mentioned before, is at the universities, in the media, in the movies, in the workplace, they are very, very subtle. And that's what makes it difficult. Can you really discover the error through just the, you know, sound good statement? You go to university and there's a club. Come and find your giftings and have a support group for developing your potential. That sounds really good. But if you really go underneath, it's all new age, right? And you get sucked into it. The English professor that questions, can you really know the author's original intent, really throws doubt as to what you can objectively know. Can you learn anything from history? Or is it just what you read into it, your interpretation? And it sounds very humble and very academic, like how can we really know? But we can really know, and it throws things really into major confusion if you start to question that, can you know anything? Is anything objective? At the workplace, political correctness culture can come across as very considerate, but really it's silencing the individual. The collective good, working together as a team, as dictated from the top, strives to put everybody into a certain mold, and there you lose your individual right to speech, different perspective, and when you do that, when everybody has to be one way, you lose creativity, you lose balance, you lose so much, but it's a huge pressure to be politically correct. This concept of tolerance. Tolerance actually means to disagree with somebody and still respect the person. And as Christians, we're all supposed to be tolerant. But that word has been changed. Now tolerance means you must accept everybody's view as truthful as your own. You cannot contradict, disagree, or argue. You have to accept it because it's right for them, and what you believe is right for you. Well, that's not tolerant at all, but our culture's in the grip of that. And even I was talking to somebody earlier in school where the kids are afraid of speaking up against the things they're being encountering because they'll be called judgmental, narrow-minded, you know, mean-spirited, all these sorts of things. And it's a control thing. So if all this sounds overwhelming and, you know, how are you going to even start to teach it and that sort of thing, because there's so much information out there, I just want you to remember that as you release your children into the real world, whether it's university or whether it's work, they don't have to know everything. They just have to have a sense that there are very dominant worldviews out there that are very different than their own that will take them to very different places. They need to understand that all ideas have consequences. It's not a matter of picking a blue Smartie over a red Smartie. It makes a huge difference. They need to be able to also think critically, and most of us in the homeschooling culture are trying to teach our children to think critically. They can't just swallow things hook, line, sinker. They've got to look at it going, okay, what is this really saying, you know, and how's it going to play out? they also need some familiarity with some resources, so that if they're not sure, they can go to a website, they can look at a book, like Josh McDowell, The New Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's just a resource book. Like, let's say you're in class and somebody's talking about, you know, feminism, you want to know where it started and what's their mandate, you take a look, you know, one paragraph, whoop, there it is, right? You don't need to take a college course for it. That they have some resources that they can just take a look at. And then the most important thing, I think, is to have really an open and safe place at home to talk about it, that you and your children can grow together in discussing it around the dinner table, so that if they get confused or something really sounds good and why is it wrong, that it's a safe place to question, to talk about it. And that's one way that you're really, really going to learn and be able to speak into their lives. So what are some ideas for how you can actually break this down for your own family? For myself, I could not shake this out of my sleeves. I've taken courses, you know, just because I've had the time and the interest. I've had curriculum that I've used. Summit Ministry has this course, Thinking Like a Christian, that really walks you through it. And I did this as a small group. You can do this as a Bible study, Sunday school youth group, just a discussion group with other teenagers in your community. Then they have also one called Countering Culture, which is an introduction to some of the worldviews, getting the teenagers, because most teenagers like to talk and discuss and debate and argue, right? So you give them a topic and a venue to really discuss their ideas and to sort of struggle with some things. So that's there. So you can add the curriculum to what you're doing. That's one way of doing it. Make it a subject part of your schooling. You can just do it, like I was saying, dinner conversations. As long as you have a little bit of knowledge, you can add it that way. And most teenagers love to discuss if they're not shot down. For example, I was again going through the newspaper, I came across this article about Bruce Cockburn. Does anybody know Bruce Cockburn? Pardon? Bruce Cockburn. Oh, okay. Well, that just shows you how with it I am. So he's a Canadian musician, as all you know, songwriter and that sort of thing. And it's his Easter message is one of hope, change, and beauty. I thought, how wonderful. A popular Canadian artist, you know, who's really got religious themes. So I read further. Talks about Easter, the holiest time on the Christian calendar, the cross, suffering, you know, power, grace. I'm going, wow, this is wonderful, right? So we go a little bit further. Talks about his lyrics. They're sort of vague. I can't quite figure it out. But it continues here. And then I get to the part, now, what does he really believe Jesus Christ ultimately offers the world? Okay, this is good. Not strict doctrine, harsh politics, or rigid morality. I went, okay, so now where does he fit in? What is his worldview? And I read a little further, and oh, he's called a postmodern psalmist. And I go, okay, maybe I won't go out and buy all of his CDs, because even though he has a lot of the same terminology as Christians, even though he's very intrigued by a lot of Christian themes and has it in his music, I would guess that he's very postmodern. And that he takes a little bit of this and he takes a little bit of that, and it's all just how you feel and, you know, perceiving and what you bring to it and your interpretation of it. And what we listen to affects us. And so you have to always ask, look further. And so you could, you know, have an article like this, bring it to the dining room table and say, okay, so, you know, kids, any concerns? What difference do you think this would make? And most newspapers are absolutely full of articles that have a bias, a worldview. And I just have, like I said before, found that most teenagers love to discuss and to be able to verbalize, like, what does it all mean? And you know, sort of talk it out and process things that way. So that would be a simpler way of doing it. There's also a course they can take in July, July 8th to 14th. Summit Ministry is putting one on in Surrey. It's you can audit it for like $195. $25, and it's Sunday to Saturday, 9 to 5. Like, this is concentrated course on worldviews. If you have a child in grade 12 and they want a ticket for credit, it's like $300 extra, and they will get university credits from Liberty University, which will transfer to UBC and other universities around. So you can do that. My oldest son is going to do that this summer, and I did that 3 years ago. So there's also focus on the family, Truth Project. Have them watch the DVD to get them thinking and that sort of thing. There's, as I mentioned, the websites that I have on the back of your handout. Summit website is excellent. There's so many resources there, and the coolest thing is on their, they have a worldview chart, and just imagine all of the worldviews listed and then the 10 disciplines across, and then each little square underneath they'll have the name for what that belief is, like moral relativism. If you click on that, you've got a paragraph summary immediately. So if you're not into getting more books, it's totally overwhelming, right, or not adding one more curriculum, you can just go to this worldview chart and you've got a complete summary right there that you can access or your children can access. So there's a lot of resources out there that you can use to educate yourself, to educate your children, and just get them thinking so that they will be able to recognize the errors in the worldviews around them. So that's sort of what I had to share this afternoon with you about what I've learned so far. And I'm wondering if anybody has any questions. Yes?
Yeah, this kind of relates to your brief mention there, specifically on the article on Bruce Coburn.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, music is an extremely important part of a teenager's life.
Mm-hmm.
It is to me also as an adult. One of the areas of, shall we say, heated debates that we have in our family is the question of what, as Christians, should we be allowing in our house? I don't mean as far as to say that, certainly, I don't think it's a good idea to be listening to Metallica and the like non-stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wonder, do you feel there's a good argument to be made that no secular music should be listened to in a Christian household? If you do, why? Why do you do? Or if you don't, why do you?
Okay, well, I started off and I started off with that perspective that no secular music in the house, because I grew up with no secular music. I grew up in a home where only classical music was played. So that's the only familiarity I have. I have almost no familiarity with cultural music. And so I didn't quite know how to judge it, right? So that's the way my children grew up, because, you know, one doesn't think through everything, and you just play your own classical music for the next generation, and you say, okay, you can listen to Christian music, modern music, but it all has to be Christian. I think I've limited it because I'm not familiar. I think it's possible for there to be non-Christian music that is just fun, that just explores life. I think that it is. But then you would have to sit down with your children, look up the lyrics on the computer, because I cannot pick out most of the lyrics when I'm listening to it, so I have to read it, and really talk about, okay, is this neutral? Does it conflict with what we believe? Because you'll absorb it if you listen to it. And so I think, no, I would say no, you can listen to secular music, but you have to really then sit down and check out all the artists. What I did come across is that there are Christian artists that I really don't appreciate. And my son would say, oh, but they're Christian. And I said, okay, let's take a look at these lyrics. They're heavily emotional. they're heavily negative, like things like, I feel like a bomb that's waiting to go off, okay, that sort of thing. They're hopeless. They focus on all of the negative sort of tormented feelings of many teenagers. And then the doctrinal truth of hope is very, very small. It's like this maybe half a line. I said, if you listen to this over and over again, does this point you to God and to His strength and to hope and to truth? No, this has you focusing on that you're confused, you don't know who you are, you just are so angry. I said, this isn't good, right? And I've had many conversations, but of course, one son doesn't think that music affects him at all. And he's listened to a lot of it, but he really struggles with depression and anxiety. So the Lord's going to have somebody else tell him the same thing, that music does affect us. And so you can, when the children are younger, you can shape or encourage a way of looking at music to ask themselves, will this affect me? Does it conflict with what is true? So that they'll really have a way of analyzing it. Because when they get older, you will have no control. And if they haven't developed that, you know, would Jesus listen to it sort of mentality, then they're going to be affected. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I agree that the examples have been given, it's fairly clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, for example, a lot of rap music, for example, has foul language, meaning to women, etc.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to say, no, this is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into the gray zones.
Mm-hmm.
For example, would you say that the Beatles is permissible in the book? Certainly, maybe the song When I'm 64, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
How about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds?
Mm-hmm.
Is that acceptable or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, then what about, say, Mark Knopfler?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe he's a Christian. I like his music much, but I think he's a Christian. Even in his songs that don't really speak of one specific worldview, should one take the approach of, well, this man is not a Christian as far as we're aware, so should we be supporting him by buying his album?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's
well, non-Christians can also discover the truth and sing about it separate from a faith in God. Like, the Christians don't have the only corner on truth. They can stumble across it and live by biblical principle, though they don't have a faith by God. So it can show up in their music. So it would really have to be song by song, right? Is this fun? Is this just, you know, an upbeat thing that helps me do the gardening or the dishes? Does it draw me towards God? Does it allow me to focus on things that really I shouldn't be focusing on? So it has to be, I think, song by song. So I'm a little bit more open to listening to more than just Christian musicians, because, as I said, some of the lyrics of Christian musicians, I'd love to talk to them in person. You know, because they have so much influence, like, and they're role models and that sort of thing. So, sorry, go ahead.
Just one of the things that we talked about with our kids, because we don't want to just shut them down.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Thank you. Any other questions? This is sort of a fast and furious presentation. So.
Most of the universities, Christian kids that go to university, like they're here, they see that the professors sing a lot of Christians, and not necessarily other faiths.
Mm-hmm.
They seem like Christians are basically
Oh, for sure, all religions are tolerated except for Christianity. And if you look at the mandate, the humanistic mandate in the education, you look at communism, their educational mandate, they have purposely decades ago said that we will infiltrate the universities, that we will set up clubs in all the universities, that we can influence the mind of the students. And it was the most unbelievable quotes that they're going after the Christians to help them see that what their parents passed on to them is outdated and irrelevant, and so it's intentional. And they have, you know, it's amazing. Kwantlen University in Surrey, the Muslims have said, we need a prayer room because we pray five times a day, and so you have to designate a prayer room. Okay, now what do you think would happen if the Christians came along and said, well, we'd like a prayer room? No. But we bow to, you know, oh, the Muslims need a prayer room because it's not Christianity, and so you have to be tolerant. But when it comes to Christianity, then all of a sudden there is no tolerance. So in the universities, yes, Christian young people are often singled out, made fun of, ridiculed, really questioned, pulled in the carpet, made look like they're outdated and dinosaurs and that sort of thing. Now, interestingly enough, my oldest, this is his second year of university at Kwantlen, he's going to UBC in the fall, and when he has written a paper from a religious slant, which is a huge risk, the profs that he has come across have not docked him marks. Because he hasn't said specifically he's Christian. So he's coming from a religious point of view. So they don't know actually whether he's Muslim or whether he's something else, you see. And so they have to be a bit more careful, because if they dock him marks, then he can cry, you know, what is it that they cry? Foul or prejudice or intolerance or whatever. And so he actually hasn't been docked marks. But it is a risk, because often they're just annihilated in the classroom. So, and, you know, I never realized how intentional communism, postmodernism, and humanism are when it comes to the education field. They are out to get the minds and the hearts of our kids. So, they just...
If those marks were docked, would it be made apparent that marks were taken away, or would it be obscured?
Be obscured. For sure. I mean, my son had to read such garbage during this English class that he took, that one day he said to me, Mom, I'm just not going to class. I'm not going to sit there and discuss that. I said, that's fine. So, and some of the novels, depressing. I mean, it's, I don't know how postmodernists actually live from day to day, that sort of thing, but it is pretty tough. If you have children that are going to go into the arts, just make sure they're really strong, they have lots of support, and that they keep talking. Because when it comes to English, it's really hard to survive it. Right? My son is majoring in history, and so that's different. You know, the war, the date of the war is still the date of the war, you know, and they haven't messed with it too much. But English lit, really, really tough. Better to do it at a Christian university, or, you know, somehow, if you're going into that sign. Any other questions, comments?
That quote by C.S. Lewis, where is that?
The quote from C.S. Lewis, it probably came from, let's see, it probably came from this book, Understanding the Times, which is a phenomenal book. This book goes through all the worldviews and the 10 disciplines, chapter by chapter, if you want a bigger resource book, or use it as curriculum.
One final thing.
Yes.
I was in the workforce about a seminar, and the topic was innately good.
Mm-hmm.
We all have some not good. And I said, okay, if you have ever been a parent, you don't teach your kids to be bad. They teach your kids to be
You know what? A baby just has to be born for you to realize how selfish all those little creatures are. Yes. Yes. That's right. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah.